Hi there, I'm Dr. Mirdalis Díaz-Ramírez, and this is the Design Your Physician Life podcast. Welcome to this episode brought to you by our Maxillary Mastermind, a personal professional development program for physicians who are ready to learn entrepreneurship. Today, we have the wonderful and amazing guest, Dr. Raj Gopalan. We're going to be talking about designing the future of medicine through informatics. Are you ready? Let's go!
Welcome to the Design Your Physician Life podcast, where you will get excited about being a physician, learn the tools that can help boost your success, and great tips from successful doctors. Join us to unlock the keys to an amazing physician life. And now, here's your host, Dr. Mirdalis Díaz-Ramírez.
Hey guys, I'm super excited today. We have Dr. Raj Gopalan in the house. Welcome to our podcast, Design Your Physician Life. How are you today?
I'm doing great, and thank you for having me.
So Dr. Gopalan is a senior physician executive with formal training and degree in medical informatics. He has over 30 years of experience that spans clinical medicine and health information technology. He has successfully designed, developed, and implemented an EMR that was judged among the top systems in the Computer World Award Ceremony at Washington, D.C. This EMR, I have to tell you that he was able to implement it in 30 hospitals within 2 years, which was a big, huge thing to do, convincing all these physicians to do that. He has presented a number of national and international conferences, and he's very passionate about healthcare analytics, artificial intelligence, and machine learning. Welcome to our podcast again. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing great.
So we always start with who was the one who decided to become a physician? Was it like little Raj or teen Raj? Who was that?
It's kind of interesting that you asked the question because I was very interested in mechanical engineering when I started, because I used to, you know, tinker my car, try to change things and things like that. And we have a strong person who's a doctor in the family. And, you know, he was pushing me to become a doctor, even though I was more interested in mechanical engineering, right? Because I'm very interested in, like, you know, tinkering around, putting things together. So what happened is getting into the medical school is extremely difficult. So basically, you know, he said that just apply. And then I applied half-heartedly into the medical school. But interestingly, I got accepted. And I said, do I really have to go through it? It was like 6 years, 1 year internship at that time. You know, I can do a master's and get a job, and I can start doing something that I'm very interested, like, you know, working on a car and things like that. He said, no. You know, people really struggle and earn for getting a position of being a physician, and you got it and you're accepted into the program. I think you have to do it. So he pushed me, right? So half-heartedly, I started, my education as a medical school student. And once I started doing that, you know, it got me really interested, you know, especially the physiology, which is more like a mechanics and anatomy, you know, looking at the different parts, you know, of the body, which is kind of similar to a car and how exactly it works. And I got very, very interested, and I said, oh, wow, this is phenomenal, right? So that actually put me on a track. Like, you know, I said, thank you. I'm really enjoying it. And like 6 years just passed like that. So I'm really fortunate to have that opportunity, and also my relative pushing it. And that is how I ended up. But my mechanical mind was still there at the back of my brain. So what happened was, in the United States, as you remember, the computer was introduced, the PC, and it was the Macintosh, which is kind of a small computer, if you remember, right, in maybe late 90s, mid 80s. So I started using that to do my work, even doing small calculations, with our clinical calculations and things like that, publishing a paper and things like that. So I got really hooked onto the computer, and I said, oh, wow, this is phenomenal. And I got really interested to pursue a career in actually doing a computer science course. I was a faculty at the University of Maryland at that time, medical school, actually teaching, you know, residents. And at that time, they said, okay, if you want to do bachelor's in computer science, you can do it as a part-time. Your tuition is completely covered. You're a faculty. So I used to run after five o'clock from the medical school campus to the, you know, technical campus, which is, you know, like 10 minutes away. And I completed bachelor's in computer science. I loved it. I used to sit up until like 2 o'clock in the middle of the night, actually doing programming and stuff like that, because it is part of the bachelor's in computer science. But I really enjoyed it. And then I got a bachelor's done. And then I was very interested in doing a master's in computer science. I said, wow, you know, this is phenomenal. I should do a master's. That is when the chief information officer, Marion Ball, she was at the University of Maryland Medical Center. I went and talked to her, you know, this is what I'm doing. I'm really interested. I want to do a master's in computer science. And she told me, Raj, you are a physician. Okay. Why don't you apply for a National Library of Medicine fellowship for medical informatics? At that time, medical informatics is kind of a new stuff because computer, you know, use a computer.
Can you tell us which year this is?
This is 91, 92, something like that, right? So, you know, I was already like, I'm from India, right? So I was working on my visas and things like that. At that time, you know, India was very particular that doctors need to come back to practice medicine back in India. And then I was already working at the University of Maryland. I published a lot of papers. And they said, don't worry about it. And we have what is called a 2-year home country requirement. Even when before I change my visa to a permanent resident or something like that, I have to go back to India and spend 2 years. So University of Maryland said, you know, if you go, all your project will be in jeopardy. So we will apply to the State Department and get you a waiver for that 2-year home country requirement. And, you know, they engaged a lawyer and went through the whole thing. And I got a waiver from this Department of State saying that, okay, this guy is important. We cannot let him go. And then I got accepted by the State Department to give a waiver. And then I was able to move on to get a green card. Because at that time, the medical informatics is only open to green card holders because, you know, the country, the U.S. doesn't want people to get trained in informatics, which is computer applications in healthcare, and go back. So at that time, you know, two universities were on the top on medical informatics. One is Stanford University. The other one is University of Pittsburgh. And a lot of faculty from Stanford actually moved over to Pittsburgh. And one was a stalwart in medical informatics called Randy Miller. He was the president of the American Medical Informatics Association. I really enjoyed his presentations and his articles. And I just picked up a phone and called him and said, I really want to work, you know, do a fellowship under you. So he said, apply for a National Library of Medicine fellowship. And I applied and I got accepted. So the NLM fellowship is something that they actually pay you your complete tuition 100% and also give you money for your living expenses because already I was married and I have two small kids. And it is all covered because they really want physicians to actually get trained in informatics and in computer science. So I got accepted. And then I spent about 4 years there doing a fellowship in the medical school at the same time doing a master's in informatics. And I focused at that time, which was actually like in the early 90s, on machine learning, believe it or not. Nobody really knew what machine learning was at that time. Computers are really very, very slow. It doesn't have the power to do it. So I have to do some of those things in a mainframe computers. And my thesis was on identifying patients who are suffering from community-acquired pneumonia, whether to treat them in the hospital or can we send them home safely. We used 40 parameters to actually train a machine learning algorithm, and we were able to, it was performed really very well in predicting that, okay, this patient, you have to keep it in the hospital because this patient may get complicated and get into, you know, greater complications. This patient, you can actually safely discharge home. So that was my thesis way back when, right? And
that was not long after the email was created, right? Email was like in 1990.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know,
it's amazing.
Right. Universities always had email but it was also like in a 3270 monitor, if you remember that, it is not like a nice, you know, interface. Email was already there. Internet was already starting. You know, we were able to get on the internet and things like that.
But it's through modem.
Through a modem.
Yeah.
Yes. Through the modem, you know, 1200 or 2400 baud, that is what they call it. It was very, very slow. You dial in modem. So yeah, I was at that time. So I finished this, right? And then, you know, I wanted to continue this. So, you know, one of the companies in the West Coast was very interested in, they are actually building an EMR system. They were collaborating with the Stanford University. So they wanted something, and the position was called a clinical architect. So they want a physician to actually think about what are all the components of the EMR and how to go about doing that. So they hired me. And at that time, remember, I was in the University of Pittsburgh, cold, dreary, snow. And this was an offer from the North Bay, San Rafael, which is actually north of San Francisco. And I was the guy who's directly hired me, who is, you know, the head of development, said that, Raj, I'm driving back home and it is a nice blue skies and the sun is shining and all that. I said, oh my God, I want to be there, you know, because I was sitting in Pittsburgh in the basement. It was like a winter, you know. So my family was also kind of excited. And we went over there. That was my first job as an informaticist and a clinical architect. And then, you know, that was my first introduction to the EMR. So, and it is a startup company, right? And I spent about 2.5-3 years there. And I moved to another company, which was actually building, you know, rule-based AI system for qualifying patients for clinical trials, like cancer patients. So how can you qualify for clinical trials? And we worked with the MD Anderson Cancer Center to actually build that application. It was actually in the 2000, when I was in California, that the dot-com burst happened. You know, all the companies are going under, as you remember, right? And I had some small kids, and I was sitting and thinking that, oh my God, you know, this is a very insecure job. What am I going to do? And then I was looking around, and I wanted a position that was much more secure. So, and we are thinking about, you know, we want to pick a place that we are going to spend a considerable amount of time. And what that place to be in terms of education, in terms of weather and all that stuff. And I chose two places, Austin, Texas, and RTP, you know, Research Triangle Park, which is North Carolina. I was extremely blessed. And University of North Carolina Hospital System called me and said, we want to build an electronic medical record. It is before Epic, before Cerner. So we want you to actually build an electronic medical record from ground up. You know, do you want to take up the challenge?
And I have a question for you before you keep up with that challenge. How is it that they got to know about you?
Well, I was applying.
They call you.
Yes, I was applying.
You were applying first. Yeah, okay.
I was applying specifically to UNC because remember, I was specifically focusing on, you know, universities and companies that are large, not like startup companies, because I already had the scar of the dot-com. So universities, I liked it because I was also interested in the research part of it. The UNC was perfect because UNC was one of the leading state universities in the country, University of North Carolina Hospital. And, you know, and the place, RTP, is the perfect that I want to spend a lot of time on. And so I came and, you know, a lot of people interviewed me and they had a lot of agenda on their plate. They said that, okay, we want this, we want that. You know, we have a kidney program. Can you also make sure that you build a kidney transplant system as well as a part of the EMR and all that stuff, right? I was so passionate and all that. And they received about my boss, who is the chief information officer at University of North Carolina Hospital System, said that we received 500 applications and we picked you. So that was like, oh my God, you know, a lot of pressure. So we moved the whole family and, you know, kids are really tiny. So that means, you know, they didn't have a lot of resistance. So we loved the place because it is unlike California, traffic and stuff like that, really green, which we loved it. And, you know, as you know, if you know Chapel Hill, it's like 2 hours from 2.5 hours from the beach on one side, if you drive east, and like mountains, if you drive like 3 hours on the west, ideal situation, right? So I started working at UNC and literally building the EMR from ground up. And this was the first web-based EMR that we built. And we built it in such a way that it is very simple for the physicians to use. And one of the things that I want to tell all the doctors and entrepreneurs is that you need to build a team, the team of all the stakeholders, and get buy-in from them. You have to have an internal marketing. So for the EMR, it is not just the doctors, the nurses, the legal system, because they are part of that, medical record, patient safety. There are a whole bunch of stakeholders who are involved in you know, the users of the EMR system, right? So I have to pull in all those people, the chief of different departments. And then I used to have meetings on how exactly the EMR should be and making sure that I address their concerns in building them. So, and also chief of departments, because it is a university hospitals, not the CEO, but the department chief has a lot of power, you know, head of internal medicine, a head of surgery, a head of pediatrics, things like that. So I had a one-on-one meeting with them talking about it, and I got them excited so that they can all support me. So I created a, you know, critical mass of top leaders in the university who can support me. That's the only way you can win. So it is actually an EMR which is developed, you know, literally my moderating it and building it with the help of all the clinicians community and all the legal medical records and things like that. So it was phenomenal. And the UI and the screen was very simple to use. If you remember the Google, when it came down, it is so simple. It only has a search bar. So that was I started in 2001. And at that time, you know, it was anything like it, because we actually made the EMR very customizable to the clinicians. So because pretty simple thing to do, what happened was a lot of physicians said that, okay, we all practice differently, you know, and because we cannot be, you know, searching for stuff, searching for drugs, searching for problems to be entered into the problem list. How can you do that? So we went back because they had EMR and data for 10 years, you know, before we started this. So I had the, you know, the advantage of having the data. So I was able to do a frequency distribution of which doctor is ordering what drug, what test, and what is the common type of patients that they see in terms of, you know, conditions. So as soon as they log in, based on the doctor, I was able to pull in the most common medications, the most common lab results or diagnostic test, and the most common diagnosis, so that they don't have to shift through the entire thing. And they said, Raj, how did you do that? How do you know that, you know, this is the one that I commonly order them? Because if you think about it from the technical side, it's very simple, right? You can go back to the lab, you know, database and look at what are all the frequencies and a frequency distribution of by users. And we are able to do that. And another thing that we are able to do that, which was kind of unheard of at that time, is you have the lab test and you also have the medications. So I said, it'll be great if we can create a graphics of when the medication was started and what was the lab results, and then follow that. Let us say if the patient has a high HbA1c or even sugar, and then metformin is started, and then they can actually see over a period of time whether the drug was working or not. Is the lab responding to the drug? And they said, this is unheard of. You know, we have to go back into the chart and literally look at it and figure things out.
Yeah, it's the science. You put it together. One of the things that we've talked about here about artificial intelligence is the quality of the data that you give to the machine is the quality of the result you're going to get.
Right.
And what you're talking is precisely that you had an advantage, you know, that you had all this data already for what they wanted. One of the things that I'm, you know, in medicine, after talking to so many physicians, it's like, oh, we do things differently, or we cannot work together, or we do this, or we do that. But in your case, you had the data of everybody, and you could personalize basically an EHR, which is amazing.
Correct. So that is what we did. It was extremely popular, 80%, you know, adoption rate. And at that time, we have the Siemens CPOE system, which is the inpatient system. And this is a electronic medical record, which served outpatient as well as all the noting, like, you know, HNP, you know, clinic note, discharge summaries and things like that. So one of the major things that was discussed at that time is medication reconciliation, which is extremely important from a physician's perspective. So what we did was we integrated the CPOE system with the EMR system, CPOE or Siemens system, with our own, you know, electronic medical record system. So that what we could do is that we can take the outpatient medications at the time of admissions and then push it over to CPOE. So the physician can look at all the home medications and they can actually reconcile the new medication that they ordered. And so that, okay, these are all the medications. You discontinue this, continue this during the period of the stay in the hospital. And at the same time, at discharge time, they were able to say that, okay, this was the original list of medications that the patient had when they came into the hospital. So they can reconcile saying that, okay, you can stop these medications, you add a couple of them, and then continue the one that you are taking before you got admitted. So this is the medication reconciliation loop from outpatient, inpatient, then from inpatient to outpatient, which was also a phenomenally important because a lot of people kind of, you know, physicians drop medications and things like that. We did that. And Siemens really loved it. And they didn't have an outpatient system. So they acquired our EMR. Siemens acquired this in 2012. So what happened was, you know, I had this, you know, programmers, like a 15 programmers on site and 15 offshore that I was, this was my baby. We called it the WebCIS, you know, web-based clinical information system. It's called WebCIS. And as soon as Siemens took over, I lost all control for it. It is almost like somebody is actually adopting my baby, right? So I was a little upset about that because previously what we were able to do is that whenever a clinician asked for something, some features, we were able to turn around and provide that features within like 2 to 3 days because it's totally under my control. But now with a large company like that, things happen very slowly because they are looking at all the rest of the customers. They'll go through the process and, you know, all this stuff takes a lot of time, it's frustration. So that has never been, you know, done for our physicians. They also really get upset for that.
You've talked about two important topics in this thing. One is before even selling the adoption of the system to physicians, you had 80%. Acceptance rate, which, you know, talking about chain management, like it's not only about doing that program, it's really accepting the program for the people who are going to be using it. Yeah. And then the other thing that you're talking about is whenever we sell our companies, they're not our babies anymore. They belong to somebody else. And that change happens just like that. You know, having sold my own company and, you know, being staying behind, you know, the frustrations because well, that's one thing that we need to understand. Like whenever we're going to sell, if it's our clinic, if it's a product or a service that you're selling, the moment that you sell, doesn't matter that you stay in the company, it's not yours any longer. So whatever the culture of your company you had, that culture is gone. It's a new team. Every time, even in your team, even if it's your company, every time you bring somebody else new or you have somebody who goes away, every time that change happens, it's a new team. And much more significant if a change is when you sell it. So it's frustrating. And yeah, that brings a lot of unhappiness to us when we don't have that capability of being such contributors in such a great way like we were before and having these freedoms that we had before. So before we go on to that stage in your life when you created your other company, tell us a little bit about that chain management, you know, for when it was in the hospital before when you created that EHR. That process, you said that you created all these teams and you created this within a company that was paying you, like the university was paying you to do this. And they were invested in this project. Any particular things that you didn't know that you would need as you were creating these teams within the hospital that served you, that helped you in creating this transition so that everybody would accept it, besides having that great data that you had?
Yeah, I mean, I was part of the staff there in that hospital. So, you know, you have to give them a little bit of what exactly, you know, if they cooperate in the whole project, what do they get? We are all looking at what is in it for me. Is it going to change my life? Is it going to make my life easier? Right. So if you're able to show them that, okay, this is your workflow right now. And it could be a doctor, it could be a medical record department, any of those things, right? So if you tell them that, okay, if you adopt this and give them examples of it, this is exactly that will be presented to you that will save you time. Today, you're spending like, you know, half an hour to get this information. Now you can get it in like 5 minutes or less than that, all the information that you want. So that actually creates a buy-in from your stakeholders. So it's always you have to look at, you know, be on the shoes of each one of those stakeholders and see what their life is on a day-to-day basis, because which means that, you know, I spend a lot of time spending in the medical record department, you know, what exactly their life is. Spend a lot of time in the ED department, what does an ED physician's workflow look like? Because they are just, you know, running around a lot of patients, you know, acute patients and all that stuff in, on the floor, on the ICU. So you get a flavor for what their life is. And then accordingly, you have to find something that you can change, even if it's one or two things that you can change that the EMR can, you know, bring about. And if you show them that, immediately they will be your greatest champion, right? So you got to do that. And, you know, this is the same thing that we did it with the Adventist Health System as well. So you have to pull them on your side. And I have an advantage because I'm not a computer guy. I'm a clinician. So they listen to me, right? Because, you know, I can tell them that I feel your pain. You know, I've been there. I understand. So immediately, you know, they will listen to you rather than dismissing you. And most of the time I hear from, you know, IT folks saying that, you know, doctors say that you don't know my workflow. You don't know that you don't know, have any idea what my, you know, day looks like. So you are trying to make my life even difficult because of bringing in all of those systems and things like that. And you mentioned about the physician burnout. We need to address that. And in Adventist, we were able to do that as well. And, you know, when we go over there, I can tell you what we did, because that's a totally different thing, because it's a vendor system. Unlike the system that I built in UNC, in the Adventist Health System, it is 30 different hospitals, 30 different culture. It is 9 states. So everyone is unique. So I got to go back and look at what the culture is. There's a lot of psychology going on there, because in Adventist, we used to give what is a questionnaire. It's called Denison's, you know, questionnaire. That'll, because a lot of people don't want to tell you what they are thinking. So if you give an anonymous questionnaire, you'll be able to find out who are all the stakeholders, like chief nursing officer, right? Chief of medical record department, the pharmacy chief. So all of them, what they are thinking, are they going to think that, okay, this is going to kind of, you know, turn their life upside down? So you get all that. And then you can have an idea about who are all the people that are risky, including the doctors, and then go back and engage them. That is extremely important because, you know, as you know, CPO implementation, a lot of hospitals failed. I mean, failure is, I mean, so, but Adventist Health System did a phenomenal job because luckily I had a mentor, you know, who is the chief medical information officer of the entire system. And he was able to kind of mentor us and train us how to even published a book. His name is Phil Smith, how to exactly implement CPOE system, because we had the luxury of doing over and over again 30 times, because we do one hospital, go back to the drawing board and say, what worked, what didn't? Can we change that so that we can do it better on the second hospital compared to the first? So we get better and better and better and better with every one of those hospitals. And we also made sure that the clinicians, because we provided them enough time to get trained, and we took the load off their practice during the training. We said that, okay, you do like, you know, 10 surgeries. Yeah, we're going to reduce it to like 3 during the training period. So don't worry about it. So you'll have enough time to get trained. Training is extremely important because they cut corners in the training. That is what frustrates doctors. And we had post-implementation and post-go-live, we need to have people on the elbow trying to help. So we had, you know, t-shirt, can I help you? Always there. So there is a process of, you know, we have established a process, like, you know, preparing the site with the executive team with all the psychology stuff that I pulled about. And we need to have the executive team behind us. We need to have the chief, the powerhouse of every hospital, identify them, and they have to be behind you. And then we need to have a very good training program, and also post-training support is extremely important. And making sure that the stuff's working, and then you can go to the next hospital because you have 30 hospital to do, but you have to come back and see how exactly it is working. We cannot just leave, and we can give them some time and then come back and see, you know, retrain a little bit of them. By the time they know the basics, but they probably don't know, you know, the nuance of it. If they can use it, they can make it even, it'll make it even better. So
I have a couple of questions for that, because you're talking about a huge process for so many hospitals in such a short period of time with many stakeholders, many users. So you're talking about, for yourself, having some systems established as a company before even going to the first hospital to make sure. And then after you're there in the first hospital for the first few days, coming back to the drawing table to make sure that everything's working and coordinating this huge effort before you can escalate to even, you know, like the second hospital and then much less 30 hospitals.
Right. Correct. That's extremely important. And you have to work with not only the hospital, but also with the Cerner system. I mean, we have Cerner. So we have to work with the Cerner staff who is on site building and all that, the different bills and things like that. Right. So it's a lot of coordination. At the same time, a lot of, we want to make this, it's a very stressful time. We had to make it a lot of fun. So every hospital, we love a theme. It could be like, you know, Star Wars theme. You know, we will have all those t-shirts and we will have all those, you know, the rockets and spaceships and stuff like that and talk about it. And then, you know, we will have like, you know, ice cream social and things like that. So we will, and also marketing material, you know, fun marketing material everywhere. So doctors cannot escape this. Oh, this is coming, you know, and the training, and we have to give them incentives to the training, you know. Doctors love pizzas. So we say, okay, we'll order a pizza and all that. So make it fun, you know. That has really helped, not only for the doctors, but also the
people. I have a question, a technical question. Who came up with all these ideas? Did you have like a team that you delegated to have this done? Yes. Did you all guys met together? Did you come up with the Star Wars idea yourself or the pizzas yourself? How did that happen in that company?
So every hospital, they have a passion for something, right? So we interviewed some of the things and we want to create a theme. So in the second hospital, we'll tell them that in the first hospital, we did this. Okay. So what is your interest? So we had a couple of hospitals in Texas. They were more interested in the rodeo and all that, right? So we had that theme. So the theme is appropriate for where the hospital is located, what is the culture of the hospital, even the local team, sports team, whatever it may be. So we created all that marketing stuff and we had tremendous help in creating all that. That really helped a lot as well. So make it a really fun stuff. And also we celebrate every milestone. We identified milestone. We celebrated it. We said, okay, without which you cannot do it. And, you know, thank people for what they have contributed and make the physicians and the top people aware of these are all our people. You know, they are the one behind this. And that makes them phenomenally purposeful in doing what they're doing. So. That's important.
You know, a common theme that I'm seeing through your conversation is something that we talked a little bit before starting our conversation here at the podcast, is that your life has been immensely great. You've been able to transfer, you know, and show your passion in life and being able to show your interest because of one important thing, which is we've been able to communicate with different teams all throughout. So from everything that you're telling me, there has been that common denominator, which at times as physicians, culturally, we have, yes, we communicate with patients and yes, we communicate with the nurses, but we don't necessarily communicate with executives and we're not necessarily having that language and that patience from us that takes to invite others to accept their ideas and have them be the leaders also of whatever it is that they're experts at. So tell us a little bit about how that has been for you and any specific tips you have for physicians, because that's not necessarily a skill that we are learning in medical school, but it's something that's so important where you want to be an entrepreneur to the degree that you've been.
Yes. One of the important things, and you said that we need to have executives don't have an idea what is the life of an ER physician. On a day-to-day basis, right? And at the same time, a ER physician doesn't have any idea what the CFO's responsibilities are, right? So what we did was we invited the executive team, could be a CEO, CFO, to spend some time, maybe half a day in the ER, just sit and observe, okay? So that'll give, maybe they, in some of the hospitals, they've never done that before, right? So that, you know, enlighten them saying that, oh my God, I never realized the life of an ER physician is so stressful, you know. So that, and also the ER physician is really thankful that our CFO is actually spending that time to watch their work, okay? Same is the way we got to, you know, take a physician and spend some time in the corporate administrative office half a day, okay? And tell what does the CFO has to do. I have a, you know, deadline, the 3-month deadline to meet. You know, we are not making money in the service units. I got to do something about it. You know, how can we do it? So they are able to understand that, and they are able to kind of help the CFO saying that, oh, is that the problem? Okay. You know, we do work this way and we can change it. It might help you. Okay. Financially. So they are able to come up from a clinical perspective. What can they change their workflow that will actually reduce the cost or whatever it may be that the CFO is looking for, right? So unfortunately, we are in silos. We work in silos. As you rightly said, communication solves a lot of problems because we don't know the other people's problem and other people's life and their work. If only we understand that, then we may be able to help each other because we are all dependent on each other for the system to work as a whole.
And one of the things that people might think is that, oh my goodness, I'm going to spend a day losing time, right? Wasting time in this other environment that's so strange to me when I have so many other things to do. But it's not really an expense or a waste. It's an investment. Ooh. So at that time, the investment is going to pay so much more in the long run because now you have made a connection. Now you know how to talk to each other. And now when you have a project, you know who's going to be in charge, how to talk to them, and what to expect. Because you know that if you've seen an emergency room physician doing their job, you know that at that point, you're not going to have any answers other than what they have to do. And if you have somebody who has a deadline as a CFO, you know how busy they are and what the deadline will be for your stuff. And then when you're designing your question to them, your request to them, then now you have a new context for that and where you can create those win-win situations. So that waste of time or spending is really an investment that you're doing there. And yeah. Now, because of that, you've been so successful and creating your company and having all these ideas, nurture and then have them become a reality. Let's talk about the future in artificial intelligence, because we want to inspire physicians to get involved in this. Tell us about what you guys are working. Tell us a little bit, you know, like we haven't really said your company, how it's structured and what you guys are doing and what you foresee for the next, I don't know, year, 5 years regarding artificial intelligence and healthcare.
Artificial intelligence is going to literally change how we practice medicine, because this is happening in the last, I would say, 5 years, especially in the healthcare field, even though artificial intelligence is extensively used in other fields, very successfully. The reason why we are behind in the usage of artificial intelligence is healthcare is a complex system. Banking is very easy in the sense that the number of variables are limited. Travel industry, the number of variables are very limited, right? Finance industry, whatever it may be. So, but one of the biggest hurdles for healthcare is that we didn't have a standard before. And we started talking about ICD codes, lawing codes, and even the notes right now, we don't have a standard. We are just writing free text, and then we are using NLP, natural language processing, to extract data and stuff like that. And there's a lot of redundancy, because one of the, my classic example is that previously, you know, before the cars, before the automobiles, people were using horses to go from one place to another, right? This brilliant guy, a mechanical engineer, said that, okay, what is the next in transportation? Okay. He only has the horse to look at. So he built a mechanical horse, okay, that has got four legs and things like that. He said, oh, that is going to be the next transportation. Okay. Marvel. But if you think about it, the car doesn't even look anything like a horse, right? So right now we are in an era of a mechanical horse. So we are looking at the paper chart, how we have been doing, you know, practicing medicine, and we want to digitize it. Okay. And that won't work because that will be a mechanical horse, you know. We want, like, to give you an example, you know, we are asking doctors to say all the things that they did, which is already there in the EMR. We know what they ordered. Okay. We know what the results are. Okay. We only want them to do, from their perspective, what does their, you know, management options, okay, using all those data. So we're asking them to again repeat all that stuff. That is where the physician burnout is. It's all there. And with technology, we can pull anything that you want. So we need to think about what is going to be a car, maybe a Tesla or whatever it may be, of healthcare EMR, which doesn't even look, which won't even look anything like what we have today. So that is where we want to get. And I think artificial intelligence will definitely help a lot in moving that transition. And also the amount of data, the articles that have been published in healthcare is just exploding. It's impossible to keep up with it. A clinician who's spending a lot of time in the hospital, tired and have no time to keep up with it, right? So the phenomenal opportunity to teach them is when they have a patient in front of them and challenged by what may be going on with the patient. If you teach them at that moment, they will never forget it. So teaching should happen at the same time they are practicing medicine. And how can we do that? Context-specific training based on that particular patient, based on that situation, right? So how can we do that? That is where AI and machine learning can help. So a physician, because when I was being trained, the senior physician, the head of the department will say that I have 30 years of experience. So that is how I diagnose patients. Okay. So what is that experience? I've also written an article on what is experience? What is the difference between a fresh medical resident who had just passed out of the medical school and a 40-year-old, attending? The difference is a lot, because when we come out of the medical school, we have book knowledge. So we want to fit a patient into what we learned in a book. And we struggle. Oh my God, I have those two symptoms, but the other two symptoms doesn't fit into this. Okay. That is how a new doctor, end doctor, will try to do it, try to, see a patient. Whereas an established doctor with 35 years of experience, they are looking at a patient and say, how many similar patients I've looked at and what did they have? And do I see any kind of commonality between that? That is experience, right? You cannot literally say, how can you transplant that experience into somebody else? No, right? But what is AI doing? AI is looking at millions of patients, not, 35 years experience of millions of doctors all put together, right? So that is what the AI is doing, is able to see a pattern of millions of patients, and then it is able to suggest with a new patient what could be wrong with them. It is almost like a super expert by your side. Okay.
Experience, as we say, experience is data. Yes. And data you can upload to a machine, and you can teach the machine how to also be compassionate.
Right. Right.
So it's going to be way different than what we know these days about how medicine could be practiced.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that the anti-AI clinicians bring up, the word called bias. If you must have heard about this, AI has bias, right? Physicians have bias too. It has been established by the heuristics. There are multiple, like framing bias, availability, heuristics. So you probably know about that, because if I see a patient with acute abdominal pain, but I know history that he is an alcoholic, guess what? I'm going to first think about his pain is probably going to the, alcoholic gastritis or things like that, right? I'll never think about maybe there's a perforation, okay? Nothing to do with alcohol, but I've already framed him in my thing that can only be due to alcohol, right? And if I've seen cardiac patient, like myocardial infarction, the first 4 days in a week, and I'm getting a patient on Friday with the chest pain, I'm going to think that this patient is a, that patient may have a dissecting aneurysm of the aorta. Totally different, right? I'll miss it.
This or a little bit of reflux.
Pardon?
Or a little bit of reflux,
Reflux, yeah. Reflux is hepatitis. So we are biased as clinicians, right? So what we need to do is that we need to make sure that the training data for AI is not biased. We want to make sure that that represents our population where we are going to use that system. So if you do that, we can minimize the bias a lot. So these are all the things that we need to kind of educate the clinicians on the value of AI so that they can embrace it. Eric Topol, he's a cardiologist. He has written multiple books on the future of medicine, and he talks about AI. And he says that a lot of doctors come to me and say that, is it going to replace doctors because they are afraid? So AI, is it going to, because they're already reading x-rays, and now we are saying that it can generate a differential diagnosis. That's all our job. We went to the medical school for that. Is computer going to replace us? I tell them that, and Eric Topol did it, I'm quoting it. It won't replace doctors. AI won't replace doctors, but it'll replace doctors who don't use them. You see what I'm saying? Because they are not using a tool. It's almost like a carpenter can make phenomenal furniture. He has the right tools. If we just take away the tools, he won't be able to do it. So you need the tools, and AI, think of it as a tool that'll help you. It's not going
to be. I think that at least on the, you know, in the very next 5 to 10 years, it's not necessarily going to replace doctors, but if you have these tools, like we see many physicians, many patients, for example, who come to us and they say, I've seen 10 physicians and nobody has been able to help me, right? And then you get this data set that you can not only have for your region, but suppose that even somebody who's traveling from somewhere else, I can maybe plug into that local data from that other place and then have the information for what people are doing there. And then that patient now doesn't have to see 10 physicians. That patient will only with one physician be able to do this, you know, to go through what they need to do to get to the root cause of the problem and solve it. So in general, from that point of view, we might need much less physicians because we can become so much more efficient. So it might not replace us as a specialty or as a profession at the beginning, but at least it's going to need, you know, we're going to need less of us because we're going to become so much more efficient.
Exactly. Exactly. And
the users, I don't know that the users that are going to come to see physicians, it's going to greatly, you know, go and increase so much that we're going to still need as many physicians. Still, we have to put that against the shortage that we've had of physicians before. So maybe now we were having these shortages of physicians. If we have these tools, then we can be more efficient. And then that kind of meets somewhere in the way. I don't know the numbers exactly, but from that point of view, you know, it's way more efficient.
Yeah, and I have a lot of respect for family physicians and internists because medicine has been compartmentalized these days. Body doesn't work like that. Super specialty actually focuses on one particular part of the body without realizing the other parts of the body, right? So the family physicians, you know, we have been talking a lot about social determinants of health, and the USDA is already thinking about making that as a part of the electronic medical record, because that's extremely important. Remember, as a family physician, we know the family, we know their life and things like that. We are able to use that also to put into perspective when we are looking at what the family member may be having, right? That is completely gone now, because every time you see a new doctor and things like that, they have no context, nothing, right? So family physician and internist look at the body as a whole, and they have a broad, knowledge, which is extremely important. And they find out that this may be the problem because I've ruled out all the rest of it. Then they can refer to the appropriate specialist for further evaluation. As you said, there's a scarcity of primary care physicians, and they are not paid well for what the work they do, right? ED physicians including, because they are also, I put them all in pediatricians, family physicians, internists, ED. It's extremely important, especially now, because we have to look at the body in its entirety. It's extremely important because body is not a separate organ system put together, if that makes sense.
So now putting it to this context, can you tell us which one or two things your company is doing or foreseeing a project specific thing that you see or something that is interesting that's coming up in the future of medicine that we are not aware of yet? And after that, tell us how people can reach out to you and your company.
Yes. So one of the things that I'm working on, which will have a great impact to the future, is the new generation of patients are much younger. They're always carrying a smartphone, right? They don't want to fix an appointment and go and see. That is why, the virtual care has exploded, because, they're very busy. They cannot do that. And they need to address their issue right then and there. if they have a pain or something like that, they cannot wait for like, you know, 1 week to get an appointment. By the time the whole thing would have been gone, right? So it's important that we need to embrace the technology to deliver healthcare, okay, to where the people are rather than pulling them to a clinic or a hospital, okay? So, and also able to diagnose with data that is very reliable, okay? One of the things that I'm looking at basically is blood, okay, and urine, blood mainly and urine, because blood kind of circulates through the body 100,000 times a day, every organ in the body, and it supplies nutrient and take waste products. The amount of information that blood has is enormous, and we have only scratched the surface. During my own research, I'm seeing that a snapshot of blood, you know, results is not telling the story. It is telling the story of how your body is doing at that particular instant. Okay. We have to look at how it kind of modulates with time, your food, your stress level, and things like that. That is what is the, you know, what is causing cancer, depression, whatever you may want to call it. So AI will be able to look at the modulation of different markers, because as a clinicians, we can only look at one marker at a time and see that if it is within the reference interval or not. Reference interval has absolutely no value nowadays with so many different ethnicity and things like that. It doesn't give us, it is actually, reference interval is actually devised based on 100 self-declared volunteers who claim that they are healthy, and they are all lab tech because that is easy access. And most of them are below 55. So reference interval doesn't even work for people over 60. Okay. But unfortunately, we are using that. So because brain cannot do complex calculations or, you know, comprehensive cognitive task. We're looking at 30 because we are ordering panels now, right? A whole bunch of tests with a higher level or lower level within the normal limits doesn't really mean that the patient is normal, because we only look at the flag. Okay. The flag is not there. We are saying, oh, you're fine. Go home. Right. But the AI is able to look at a combination of markers based on millions of patients who ended up with cancer, so that we can go back and look at their blood 3 years before, how exactly the pattern was, and able to predict the risk of the future. Okay, that doesn't mean that you're going to have cancer, but you can actually see the individual, you know, normal test. I'm only focusing on normal blood results, lipid panel, CMP, you know, CBC, because this is easily available. Even during the wellness exam, you get it done, even during surgery. That is a huge goldmine of data that we can use using AI to be able to predict the risk for all sorts of diseases. I've done quite a bit of studies on a number of leading cancers, chronic diseases, and there's a great potential in doing that. And this can be done using smartphone. You know, we can identify patients early and deliver them care. That is extremely important to even bring down the cost of care in the US, which is kind of getting to be like 17 to 18% of the GDP. It is not self-sustaining. We are only sixth in the whole world in terms of outcomes. People who are spending much less than us have better outcome. There's something wrong here.
So, you know, earlier you talked about Star Wars. I'm going to talk to you about Star Trek, where I don't know if you remember in Star Trek, you had the doctor. It was a female doctor that would come with this little machine, and she would like, and then scan the person up, you know, head to toe, and say, okay, you have this. I'm waiting for that machine. I think I'm going to be able to see it. Do you see something like that happening in the future of healthcare?
If you look at the blood monitoring, blood sugar monitoring, right? Now we are looking about sensors that constantly monitor your blood sugar, right? People are able to see how my blood sugar is changing with the diet that they eat, the activity that I did, right? Not just once in 3 months, once in 6 months, a blood panel, right? That doesn't make any sense. So in the future, it's going to be not just sugar. It could be sodium, potassium. Okay. All that, it's scary from one look at it. Oh my God. You know, am I going to be okay? On one side of it, that is the scare is there, right? We are going to have a constant dynamic dashboard of our body,
plug into our shoulder.
Yeah. One patch, it will be all sensing all that. in a way, it's important because people can monitor how you're doing and, you know, get you help even before it is, you know, critical. I'm working on right now on stroke. If you think about stroke, 1 minute delay, if the patient has a stroke, 1 minute delay will kill 2 million neurons. And those 2 million neurons, if you lay them, you know, end to end, is 7.5 miles of neuron every minute. Okay. So what do we want to do? We have to intervene within 2 to 3 hours of the symptoms of stroke. But not everybody can get that because they may be far away from the hospital. So is it possible using blood tests to be able to identify the risk days before, not hours before, days before, so that we can give them, you know, appropriate intervention.
So it's all like, to me, my mind is like right now, it's bursting with ideas. It's awesome. Thank you for coming to our podcast. And how can people reach you? How can people either, you know, hire a company or want to talk to you about all these ideas and work with you? What's the best way?
They can reach me on LinkedIn. If you type Raj Gopalan, you know, it'll take you right there. So it is actually the LinkedIn /Raj-Gopalan-MD. But if you type in Raj Gopalan, it'll get you there. And if they want to reach me by email, because I don't have Facebook or Twitter. And I only have LinkedIn is only my main social platform, media platform. If they want to reach me by email, it is BSRM, B for boy, S as in Sam, R for Roger, M for Mary, BSRMconsulting.com. Raj.Gopalan@BSRMconsulting.com. So they can reach me there as well.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I'm looking forward to see what you have, you know, with these ideas that you're developing. And thank you. I'm super grateful that you've been here and it's been quite the episode. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mitralis, and for having me on your show and looking forward to more.
You know. Yeah, we're going to have a part two of this conversation for sure, because I know that there's so many more ideas that we can talk about that it's going to be wonderful. We promise we're going to bring that one.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, guys, that was it for today. I hope that you had a wonderful time like I did with Dr. Raj Gopalan in our conversation today about designing the future of medicine through informatics. You can actually reach him through LinkedIn like I did. If you want to listen more, please stay tuned for Design Your Physician Life podcast. You can now reach us through our new YouTube channel, which is called Maxillary Mastermind, where we're not only giving you our podcast, we're also giving you extra information from our live sessions that we have every Friday on Facebook. I hope that you share this with your friends and family. Give us 5 stars and we'll see you later. Thanks. Bye.
Please remember that Design is not providing specific financial, medical, or career advice. Our only intent is to stimulate your appetite for growth by sharing our experience and those of our speakers, coaches, and guests. Your personal growth and success will be unique to your circumstances and your hard work. We sincerely hope you enjoy the show and look forward to seeing you next week.